Good evening, everybody. My name is Hiroshi Sasaki. I am an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here, grateful to be sober. I know I've been introduced as Hiro. That's the shortened version of my name. I named myself that, like in Tucson, right before nursery school. So that's fine. You can call me Hiro. You can call me Hiroshi. You can call me Hiroshi. It doesn't matter. Thank you, Sharon, for that 10 minutes. Thank you, Mark, for asking me to come out and share here at High Desert. Sunday at 6 is so much more civilized. It works well. But it's okay, though, because, I mean, for 12 years, I was sponsored by Bob D out in Vegas, so really kind of like 6 hours in traffic is my idea of, like, any lengths. So I have a sobriety date. It's November 12, 2007. I have a sponsor. His name is Larry J. I've got a home group. It's the Bellflower Big Book Group, and I'm really grateful for those things. Hey, if you're ever in town, if you're ever going to come down south, come and get my card and on a Monday, and like hit me up like a couple of weeks in advance. I'll change my schedule, and we'll meet up when all the people are freakishly early. Like, people get here freakishly early. I don't know if you know that. In order to make this room set up like this, like, we got here like an hour early. The room was already set up, and all the coffee was already getting started. Like people work hard in order to make this thing run smoothly, and so if you get my number, we'll show up like when they're setting up the room, like 3 hours early. It's ridiculous. And we'll say hi to the people that are setting up and thank them, and then we'll go grab some dinner, and then we'll come back. And we have this little beginners meeting before the main meeting. It starts at 6:15, and someone shares about what the first 90 days was like. Welcome to Ophelia and to Dan. For all the Spanish speakers in the house, if you ever forget how to like pronounce Japanese, why would you even remember? But if you ever want to know how to pronounce Japanese, all the vowel sounds are the same as Espanol, so it's really really easy. So. There's someone who shares about what the first 90 days are like for 15 minutes. And there's an ask it basket that goes around the room, this person hasn't done this in a while. There used to be somebody who, I don't know who it was, who like, are you a miracle? And I hated this question. It was a trick question. And the answer is this. The Big Book says that if you're here and if you're someone who drinks because it's a bad day, it's a good day because you're bored or because it's at hand, and if you're somebody for whom that causes major problems, and you're somebody who even with time stopped, you end up doing that again, accidentally causing all the major problems. But if you are now here and you've stopped for a period of time, the Big Book tells us that we're miracles of recovery. In fact, if you're here now, you are the location of a miracle, because you are the location, you are the place where the impossible takes place. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new here, or if you're struggling in your life and you haven't had a drink in a while, welcome to the place where the impossible takes place. And if you stick around here and get a sponsor and get a commitment in this group, take these steps and do all the things, all the internal stuff that helps me to live with me, and perhaps, probably a lot less difficult to live with all of you, even though you are difficult. But it's mostly me. That's what we learn, and I need to clear out everything that's in here. So someone shares about that. So like, there's that, are you a miracle? Or like, why are you sober? And the answer to that question is easy. I'm sober today for a number of reasons. I know the person who writes that question. It's a trick question. He's really trying to see if you answer so I could help others. But really, there's so many other answers, including like, if you're having a bad day, welcome. We can make it so much worse. Let's just like light up some rails and just line up the shots and just have the beer backs and just over and over. Bah, 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 bah. And we could, like, if we all did that right now, we would make this entire town have a bad night. Right? It would just not be good. So no matter how bad things are today, we can make it so much worse, which is the lovely thing about being an alcoholic. So anyway, so there's a little ask it back. So they answer all the questions. And then afterwards, then you see us all like, basically there's, our home group fills up to be about 300 people on a Monday night, right? And so for the beginners meeting, there's, like about 75 core people. And you'll see us all like line up and we're praying out with the Lord's Prayer. And then you'll see us like stay in line. And what we're doing is we're going to thank the speaker. And then you see us like scatter like little ants. And like the vapors and the smokers are going out to the vaping and smoking area because that's important. And the rest of us are rushing off to our commitments. And I really miss my old commitment. My old commitment was, well, they called it Bathroom Captain, but I called it Captain Bathroom because, of course. But this year, the last year and this year, they're trusting me with the money, which is crazy, right? Because if you have money, it's for spending. Apparently, that's not the case now, College Anonymous. It's for self-support. Yeah, that took a while. And then what happens is that you know, from if you're somebody who thinks a lot and it doesn't go well, like you're someone who like thinks and you think stuff like, oh man, I suck so much, I suck more than anyone has ever sucked before, and then you notice like some ass acting like an idiot, ass is in the Bible, you see some ass, you add hole to it and suddenly it becomes profane, I don't know why, you see some ass acting like an ass, and then all of a sudden you're like, except for that guy, and you're like, oh, and then you're grinding on that guy. If you've got a mind that like disrupts your serenity, then come and get in the greeting line with me, man. Because the greeting line is crazy. At about 7:10, 7:15, like Sharon knows, the greeting line gets to be like that movie that the young people know as Episode 4, but the rest of us older people, like those of us who are born in the 1900s, know of as Star Wars. There's that moment when you know, at like right before the finale, all the, you know, they're trying to go into the Death Star, and like Red Leader 2 is like they're coming in too fast. Like that's what it's like with all the people coming in. Like the door gets like clogged with people coming into the greeting line. And it's like one person after another. You're like welcoming them to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're someone like me, where your thinking causes you in immense pain, then just trying to remember three new names. Just remembering three new names and just welcome each person is a challenge in and of itself, and you'll discover this thing that happens if you're earnest about trying to remember three new names and welcoming each person that you shake their hand. You'll discover that for seconds and even minutes at a time, you don't think about yourself. It's divine. It's so good. And then the bell rings, and then you know, a little bit before the bell rings, I'm watching my clock. I go wash the alcoholics off my hands, like I just did a few minutes ago. And then we go and sit down. We have like two 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. So if you're ever in down south, let me know. And love to have you join us. That's me breathing and praying. That's me breathing and praying and asking God, you know, what now? What do I do now? How can I best serve your kids? That's me breathing and praying, you know, God, I'm willing to be embarrassed, but I hope it's not necessary. That's me breathing and praying, you know, like, show me your will for me and grant me the power to carry the message you'd have me carry. I don't know. I already started speaking a little bit of Spanish. So I like the Spanish Big Book. I don't know if you know that, like AA in North America and Hawaii, and also our outlying little territories, like you know, in the Caribbean and also Guam. We have three official languages. Like we got English, we got Spanish, and we got French. And so this is AA. This is the place where we come if we take a drink and things go really badly, and we can't predict when that's going to happen. And for people who like drink for long enough, it's like every time. And for people who like, once that happens, like some people are able to just go, oh yeah, this is bad, I'm just gonna stop. And they just stop forever, no AA. And they're happy. Those people are not like me. Those people are not like me. I drank and used for 30 years, but I've never been arrested for like drunk driving, even though I've driven drunk with confidence many a time. I was lucky. I've never been confined against my will, even though I've been suicidal and homicidal at different times, sometimes both at the same time. I just never told the wrong people. I imagine I could make that happen if I decide to go take a drink today. I can make that happen. But the other really confusing thing is we decide not to drink, and all of a sudden we find ourselves drinking again. Which is weird. To me, when I heard that thing about having no power, choice, or control over the first drink, like, this made no sense to me. Like, my phenomenology, my lived experience, my experience of myself, my subjectivity is this. Every single first drink, I chose. I chose every single first drink. But it kind of reminds me of that that animated feature from Disney, that really old one, Pinocchio, where like, you know, like where the you know, the little marionette turns into a wooden boy, like comes alive, and like he's going off to school, and Geppetto the woodcutter sends him to school with like his little books that are tied around with a ribbon and his little apple, and he's got his conscience with him, and his conscience is the form of Jiminy Cricket, this little talking cricket. And he's halfway to school, and he runs into, what is it, like the wolf and the fox? And the wolf and the fox are like, hey, we're about to go to Pleasure Island. We're going to shoot some pool, drink some beers. It's going to be great. It's just going to take the lid off. It'll be wonderful. And of course, the conscience is telling him no, but one of them's actually gone bink when he wasn't looking. And, you know, so now his conscience is in the back, and it's like, you know, if I'm Pinocchio, it's like Jiminy Cricket's in the back going, don't go off with the fox and the hat, with the wolf, fox and the wolf, hero. It's a bad idea, hero. No, if you do that, you'll turn into an ass. And I can't hear him. He's way back there. He's in the corner. Right, and I can't hear him. And so I make the decision. It feels like my own decision. Like my alcoholism hijacks my will. And it says, this is a civilized thing. Like my last run was started with a wine tasting, which is so civilized. Those, you start from light to dark, and back then in 2007, like intermittent fasting wasn't a thing, but it always was for me if I knew I was going to drink, because then, you know, a little takes you further, and I was poor then, so, you know, just a few bucks can like take me downtown. Wonderful. And it just turned out badly. But the third part is, you take me away from a drink for a while, and I have unmanageability. Like the Big Book talks about, you know, the restless, irritable discontent. Sharon talked about that. It also talks about the bedevilments. I'm full of fear, can't seem to be of help to anyone, prey to misery and depression, right? Can't seem to make a living, can't seem to be helpful to anybody. And what I love about the Spanish Big Book is that in Spanish, it says, nuestras vidas, our lives have become ingobernables, like ungovernable. Right? I want to start like a punk Frontera band where that's called Los Ingobernables. Like it's all just like recovered alcoholics, right? In French, the other official language, we've lost la maîtrise, the mastery over. That's all I wanted. Like drinking helped me feel like I had mastery over everything. I'm like master over my domain. That's a different thing. Anyway, so for the Seinfeld people in the room that remember that. Anyway, so and in Japanese, it's omoi dori ni ikite kanakatta, which is the literal translation is we couldn't live our lives the way we thought. But the heart of it is we couldn't live our lives the way we wanted. Now think about this. I'm a kid that can't live my life the way I want because, well, first, I'm a kid. I can't just do what I want. But second, I'm a kid that's made in Japan, that was brought here against my will, and my parents are freaking weird. And that weirdness, I realized later on, in the fifth step, they're Japanese. But at the time, I thought they were weird, we looked weird, we sounded weird, so I couldn't live my life the way I wanted. But then when I find alcohol, it's like, oh, I can feel exactly the way I want to feel when I follow some simple directions. Follow some simple directions, and I drink just that way, and I smoke some weed just the way I was taught to do, and hold it in, and try not to cough it out. That's a waste, and all that stuff, right? I follow some simple directions, and I'm living the way I want. But unfortunately, the half life on that is really short. You got to like keep adding more weed and alcohol and whatever else you can find. And so when I first like realized what it was in Japanese, now mind you. My friend Judy Caduti, who I met in the Wednesday night Big Book study of the Big Book group, she was a Japanese American, was in the camps, would talk about the camps, got sober in 1970, was sponsored by the founder of my home group, Johnny Harris's spouse, Dottie Harris. I'm saying their full names because they both passed away. And so Judy saw me and she's like, are you Japanese? And I'm like, I am. I didn't know that was a requirement. And she goes, it's not. I'm just happy to see you. And she would have me like drive her to the Japanese-speaking meeting on Tuesdays, and in Gardena, the only Japanese-speaking meeting in all of AA in the U.S., Canada, and even Hawaii at the time. Now it's all on Zoom. And so they would read the 12 steps in Japanese, and every night. And I didn't actually, you know how it is when you're like at a meeting and Alex will come up and read, and another person will come up, and you don't hear a thing. You're thinking, oh, what's that person over there doing? And that's why I like sitting in the front. I can only see the speaker. But then I'm listening. I'm listening in 2019. My dad's dying. I'm listening in 2019, and I hear it, and I think, oh, my God. What I wanted during my drinking was to drink just the way I wanted. I hated it when people would get in the way. When you start drinking at 12, a lot of people get in the way, you know, like teachers, counselors, parents, adults. And all I wanted was to drink the way I want. And what I realized is when I live the way I want, I'm going to drink the way I want. I'm a peak experience guy. I want to be as drunk or as high as F all the time, right? And but I don't have enough money for that. I don't have enough supply for that. And but the thing is that when I start living the way I want and drinking the way I want, I end up finding that my life isn't the way I want. In fact, I can't live the way I want. What I discover is when I live the way I want, that I end up in a place where I don't even want to live. Age 16, handful of Valium, handful of Librium, bottle of Bacardi 151. Now, somebody was sharing from our podium and talking about how alcohol kept them alive. And that's true for me because what happened was I carefully calculated this out. It was going to cross the blood-brain barrier. I was just going to just fall asleep, pass out, and then just be gone. Just done. And I was excited about this. I didn't write a note because I was so angry at my parents. Once again, hashtag fifth step for being Japanese. I didn't know it was for being Japanese. They were just wrong. And I forgot I was a puker, right? Because I'm like half the Japanese population. I turned bright red. I've got the natural born antabuse on board. So that's why instead of being dead and having someone else be here as a speaker for you, I just came to with a half dissolved pills and that lake of vomit on the shag carpet and had a cleanup in my room. And my parents didn't even know that had happened. My room just smelled like my room. It was a boy's room, you know. Except it smelled, had the like an undertone of vomit, like a good dirty bar, and. And I'm so grateful. I don't come in here until the age of 42. I don't come in here until the age of 42 because I can control and enjoy my drinking. In fact, I'm so focused on controlling and enjoying my drinking because, well, you know, you would too if unlike you, I can't do that thing. I can't drink, drunk, puke, rinse, repeat. Like, I can't rally. Once I'm at that alcohol toxicity, I'm done. And I'm done for the next 12 to 36 hours because my esophagus feels like a dirty sock that's turned inside out. I'm like trying to just get a little bit in so that I've got something other than like tissue to throw up, right? And so I want to avoid that drink. I want to avoid that drink. And some of you have maybe spent your entire drinking career trying to avoid the drink that gets you into a fight or ends you up in handcuffs or ends you up, oh, I hate this one, waking up in the morning next to it, and you look over and you notice that its eyes, in its eyes, you're realizing, oh, crap, I'm its it. Oh. Not good. Not good. Yeah, when my former sponsor, Bob D, would talk about that, I would just, oh, I would always have that shudder. Yeah, it's kind of like a post-vomit shudder. It's like, oh, yeah. So another reason that I didn't think I was an alcoholic is that I've never met the criteria for alcohol dependence disorder in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. You know, I've never had DTs. I've never had withdrawals. And it's wonderful that here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can have this entire range. And I love that... that my former sponsor, we lost so many good folks last year. We lost Johnny Harris, the founder of my home group, and he sponsored me for the last 381 days of his life. And it's wonderful. I don't know if you ever have a chance to do this. It's wonderful having a 94-year-old sponsor me, like who's been sober for like, you know, almost three quarters of a century. And it's wonderful. Like call this guy up in the morning and then like whine to like a 94-year-old. You know, with 64 years sobriety, and you're looking, yeah, it's one of the best things ever because you can't take yourself too seriously, you know, which is the goal, and man, we lost Larry Thomas. Like Larry would love for all the newcomers and people who are struggling to know, you know, like welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, welcome to being divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your life, you know, and both of them would want you to know that if you're coming here to take something, all we got is alcoholism, man. That's all there is here to take. But if you come here and get a little job in this group, and you come to serve the group, and you take these steps, a lot of people talk about working the steps, and that's fine. If that's what your sponsor calls it, your sponsor's right, not me. But my sponsor, my late sponsor, Johnny, would talk about the book talks about taking the steps. And in Japanese, it's step wo humu, and humu is the verb for to take a step. So you're taking a step into a step. And so that's all we're doing. You know that poem, The Footsteps on the Beach? I'm just following the footsteps of the drunk with time in front of me, and I'm just following the same footsteps, and he's showing me what steps to, and it's like if you ever like walk in a precarious area, whether it's a mountain or like on the beach with the rocks that are slippery, and you have that perfect spot to step into, that's all the steps are for. That's it. And but all of a sudden, I didn't think, I don't need these. Like, I'm fine. I'm fine just as I am. And I'm fine taking 7 years to graduate from UCLA instead of 4. I'm fine dropping out of 2 PhD programs in English literature. I'm fine on a second one having a full ride there, teaching freshman writing and not being able to finish half my papers. I'm fine going to my classes, reading all the readings, talking about it, but having the hubris, having the entitlement and the audacity to think, I don't need to write that damn paper, man. I've already thought it out. I've talked to you about it endlessly. Like, why do I have to write it? The answer of why I have to write it is that's the paycheck. That's the A. That's the only way. That's the hard work. And I don't want to do the hard work. Why don't I want to do the hard work? I've got one explanation. Well, I'm lazy. But the other explanation is this. I'm gifted. I was told I was gifted since I was a child. And there's this weird thing that happens to gifted kids in the West. What happens to us is that we don't want to work hard at things that are hard because some of the things that are hard for other people are easy to us. And then we start thinking, oh, if it takes hard work, then it's not worth doing. When the answer is only the things that are worth doing are hard. That's it. Only the things that are worth doing are hard. And also, I don't like failure because if I'm really good at something, I'm really good at being perfect in one little area, one tiny little domain. And if I'm imperfect in other areas, then I would... I was having this conversation about the Middle East a little earlier, not in a political way, but in terms of art. And I don't know if you know about Islamic art. Like traditional, there's a form of traditional Islamic geometrical art where the artist will always put a flaw in the art. And this always drove me crazy. I'm like, why did they put a flaw in there? The answer is only the divine can create perfection. Oh, I love that. That I get to be perfectly imperfect, and I don't know that that's desirable. I don't know that. All I know is I'm double lifing of my entire life. Like I'm trying to show you something that I'm not, until I can't even show you what I'm not. I show you what I am, and that feels horrible when you know in my drinking. That's just ugh. If you need Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a few people, including Johnny, that it's really important that unmanageability piece. That not being able to live the way I want to, that being ingubernable, you know, the ungovernable, that not having mastery over my life, like I try as hard as I can, and something always seems to go wrong. And living like that makes me thirsty, whether it's a manifestation in resentment or in fear. And I love what Johnny said. I heard him say this when I was about 30 days sober and 16 years before I would ask him to sponsor me. And I heard him say at the 502 Club that the 12 steps exist so I could empty me of me and automatically fill up with this thing called God. Automatically fill up with it. My friend Ralph W. like summarizes that into 4 words. And I'll put my name in instead of his. Like shrink hero, grow God. Shrink hero, grow God. And... And I thought that's what I was doing all along. Like, that's what a drink would do. It would shrink me enough so I can get out of my own way so I could have fun. Shrink me enough that I can get out of the way and I could come out and play with all of you. Nutty. And I came in here with all these preconceived notions. Now, I, 6 months before my sobriety date, I'm just about, I've done with all the coursework in a PhD. I'm working in a hospital, and I have a psychotic episode in the hospital. And instead of going to try and provide psychotherapy to a seven-year-old, I go to my bosses, and they tell me to, like, go talk to the employee assistance program, take some time off, get better, come back when I'm feeling better, make sure to bring a note, did all that. Come back to the pre-doctoral internship. All I have to do is I've got to finish this doctorate, which is this dissertation, which is a really long paper, that I'm at the tail end of, finish the hours at this hospital, and then I'll be done. Then I would have this PhD. Then, and I've been, you know, and I know all I have to do is not drink. And of course, someone invites me to that wine tasting, and I take it. And within 30 days, I'm crazy. And my wife, who I'm still married to, we met in 91 at that second PhD program I dropped out of. We get together in 92 during the civil unrest that was called the LA riots. We get married in 95. And I get sober in 2007. That'll tell you two things. I'm very exciting until I'm terrifying. And, like, the staying power on that woman. And we're still married today. We just celebrated 30 years married this past, the last May. And, but she confronts me with those dead glass taxidermy eyes. You know, the ones that, it's like she's part owl now, and she's got the nictitating membranes. They're like, blink, blink, contempt. Blink, blink, disgust. Blink, blink, horror. Blink, blink, just bewilderment. Like, give me back those that debit card and Visa cards. Like, give me all your cards. We might be done. Apparently, I had spent like $1,000 on closet organizers that we don't need. And so, that's how she caught me. Well, that's how she realized how far gone I was. And I didn't know what to do, and I make an SOS phone call to a friend. I don't call any of you. I don't call any sober alcoholics. I knew a lot of you. You seemed happy. That's not for me. You don't have my answer. I call my friend Mary. It's Friday night, 9:30 p.m. She picks up on the third ring, and I'm on the phone telling the absolute truth for the first time. I'm reaching out for help. It's an SOS phone call. I'm not an alcoholic. I don't trust my shrink. I need a new shrink. I think I'm bipolar. I think I need some lithium. I'm talking a mile a minute. I'm completely manic. I'm talking faster than I am right now, if you can imagine it. And she asked me the only question that you could think of to ask of this person who's clearly terrified and manic, and she says, "Hero, what's going on?" Now, I pride myself on honesty. I feel like I've been honest all my life. I'm just really careful about who I'm honest about what to. So, because, you know, if you're completely honest with all your medical providers, you can't get all the prescriptions you need. So let's give them this part. Like, oh, you get to know about my migraines. Oh, you get to know about my anxiety. Oh, you get, right? And you get a whole, like, cornucopia of things. And so, but here I tell her everything. No lies of omission, like Sharon was talking about. And I'm burned for like 20 minutes, talking about all the skeezy acting out I'm doing, all the crap I'm pouring into my body just to get to okay. I can't get to okay. My body can get drunk. My body can be high, but my mind won't shut off, and it's still telling me, "Hero, you suck more than anyone's ever sucked before." Yeah. And after 20 minutes, I'm done, and there's silence on the phone. I mean, it's terrifying. It's like this yawning abyss, and probably only a few microseconds, and then she says, "Hero, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober for 22 years. Maybe you need a meeting." And it's like a branch 2 inches below my belly button that just goes pop, and I just start sobbing. Like full body stomach crunches, like chuck, chuck, like snot pouring out the nose, ugly cry crying, right? And because she's the one who taught me how to send you to Alcoholics Anonymous. She's the one who taught me to tell you things like, they know how to stay sober at AA. You might not drink right. You might need them to help you with that. I can't help you with that. She taught me to tell you, hey, if you go to AA and you don't believe you're an alcoholic, don't worry about that. Let's just go to an open meeting. She would have me hand you an AA meeting directory, because this is before the digital age of like the meeting guide, the little blue chair app that we can all use. And tell you the difference between an open and closed meeting. Open, anyone can go. Closed, for alcoholics only. She told me to tell you, if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, go there to identify, not compare. Go there to listen for similarities, not differences. And she also told me to tell you this really bizarre thing. She said, if you hear about God, you might hear a lot about God, and you don't believe in God, you have trouble with God, don't worry about that. That's advanced Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a later step. And that was incredibly useful for me. So it turned out that I came in not believing in God. I also didn't disbelieve in God. And my experience of God there's a form of theology called apophatic theology. It's basically what all mystics do. They eliminate all the things that God isn't, right? And then so that you can start to have access to this thing that is ineffable. You can't. There are no words to describe this God, but of course thousands and thousands of pages, millions of pages have been written in theological books trying to describe this God. But here's my experience of God through Alcoholics Anonymous. We can only really use parables, right? And so it's kind of like what Sharon and I are doing driving up here. We've got my friend, my sponsee, Lil, in Edmonton, and Lil's reading us about steps 4 and 5 because Sharon is well launched into that process, and we're wide awake, like we're waking up, we're wide awake. And here's what wide awake means: it's almost as if we're all on a tour bus. And we're going through gorgeous territory. This comes from one of my teachers, Father Anthony DeMello. And we're going through the most gorgeous country in the world, but all the blinds are drawn. And instead, we're inside arguing about who gets to sit in the favored chair, and we're having arguments instead of just like marveling at the gorgeous scenery outside, because we're asleep. We're asleep to ourselves. We're asleep to the fact that, you know, that there was a mystic named Julian of Norwich. Now Julian, little tiny French woman, in the 1400s, and she's in Norwich, France, and she basically is an anchorite. She's like goes into this tiny little room, like little 10x10 room, and she gets food given to her, and she's in there basically praying and meditating and having visions of God, and she writes them all down in this thing called Revelation of Divine Love. Now my wife's the medievalist, not me, but I learned about this woman from Stephen King. Anyway, so she's writing in there, and she has this revelation, which is all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of thing shall be well. What I know is that for a short period of time, if you give me my drugs and alcohol, I can reach that spot. But it's costly. I can get the all shall be well, in fact, all is well, feeling at the cost of making sure that all ain't well at all for a longer period of time. And I'm like Wimpy from the old Popeye cartoon. Right, I'll gladly pay you for a wimp. I'll gladly pay you on Thursday for a Wimpy burger today. Thursday comes, I don't have the money. It's like my first sponsor, Bill would tell me, he would say, buddy, you can do anything you want in sobriety as long as you're willing to pay the price, but remember, you're rarely willing to pay the price. I'm like, oh, you know me so well. And it's strange because, because I've been a seeker all my life. My mom was always a seeker, and she passed away in 2020. And as a result of having a home group, having a sponsor, having taking these steps, and seeking, I want everything to be okay, and things are so not okay. And I asked someone to sponsor me, and I start doing the things that he asked me to do. And it's kind of my friend Lori S. from the Paramount Group. She talks about it like this. She answered the phone when we're hanging out together with our two sponsees. Like I sponsor Joji, and she sponsors Lisa, who is now Lisa G, that got married in sobriety. And Lori was explaining to me, well, she says, you know, I tell my newcomers, AA is kind of like, it's really bizarre. Like, if you want to get the lawn mowed, you do the dishes. Right? And so I catch her on the phone, and she's like, hey, well, I see you at the meeting, and this is a girl that she was talking to who's like, I can't make it to 3 meetings a week. I can't. And she goes, hey, can you make it tonight? And the girl finally suffered enough to get it. She's like, yeah, I'm willing to wash the dishes. Because what we do, we don't take problems head on. We eliminate, instead of, like, I think the problem is I don't have enough money. I think the problem is my car doesn't work right. I think the problem is there's something wrong with my relationship. I think the problem is that I don't get enough respect at work. And it turns out that if my main problem is alcoholism, and I'm really, really good at feeling bad, and I know that alcohol is going to fix it, and I know that I'm going to go and get the alcohol, which will make sure that that my feeling bad skills go into overdrive. If I want to not do that, I have to do these things that make absolutely no freaking sense at all.
like, oh yeah, I'm gonna get on my knees in the morning and pray, and then get on my knees at night and pray again. And it's really good for me to understand that prayer for anyone who doesn't believe in God or a higher power is really, really simple. The materialist version of prayer is setting my intention to turn my attention to something much bigger than me. Setting my intention to turn my attention to a power that's greater than me. Now, in my studies in theology and philosophy, sober, I learned about. I'm reading like a Jewish text. I'm reading out of the Medrash, which is it looks like it's pronounced Midrash, but it's like Medrash. It's basically all the teaching tales that go alongside the Torah, and I'm reading about like Hashem talking to Moshe, and I'm like, who are these people? And I look up, I hop onto like Google, and Hashem is a name for God, which means the name. And Moshe is just Moses. It's just talking about like God talking to Moses, right? And I spent a lot of my early sobriety trying to name God. And it turns out that the Jews will call God the name instead of like El Shaddai or Yahweh. Or there's all these names for God, but the nickname is just the name. And that's all we need to find. We just find that whatever name will work. And it turns out, like one of the guys that Johnny also sponsored, who really carried the message to me, was this guy named Jason Smith. He passed away in 2010. He told me early on in my first couple months of sobriety, he said, "I know you have problems with the thing called God. Don't worry about it. Step one is I can't drink right. I can't not drink right. And no matter what, I can't manage my life today. Step two, I can't do it alone. Step three, a decision to take the rest of the steps." When I argued with him, because I was ready to argue with anybody, including a little bit my sponsor, but not as much. He said, and my arguments were sound, like the higher God as we understand him and all that. He said, "Don't worry about that." He told me a story that Johnny had told him that Chuck C had told Johnny, where God abhors a vacuum, that all we have to do is empty ourselves of ourselves and we'll automatically fill up with this God. And I heard Johnny say that also, and And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what this higher power is. As long as we do these things, we're actually, and we could even use a doorknob. It doesn't matter. Doorknob is actually kind of poetic. Like I stand by the door, like open the door, like let something in. Or one of my favorite gods to study, the god Ganesh, the elephant-headed god of the Hindus. He's the removal of obstacles and opener of doors. Like, I need a remover of obstacles today, man. And that dog god came through, man, because I'm like smooth sailing all the way here on traffic. And but whatever power that we're praying to, that's the power. We're going to have a relationship to a power that we couldn't possibly have named, that we couldn't possibly have listed all the characteristics of, that we couldn't possibly, to be able to have a relationship with a power that is absolutely freaking crazy about you. That's what this is for. A power that just adores you and wants you to be happy. And I had a buddy of mine, Aaron. He was asking me about, like, what do you do? Because, I'm a psychologist in my civilian life here in AA. I'm just an AA. And he's like, what do you do when you have patients who don't, is God helpful? Like, with people who are atheists? I'm like, God is always helpful. Like, I pray beforehand, just like I pray before, like, working with a sponsee. I pray right before getting in the car. I pray before, like, coming up here. Sometimes I forget and I suffer. And then I'm reminded. And then I pray again. And so Aaron's asked me, what do you do with patients or with AAs who don't believe in God? And I'm like, that's not a problem. That's never a problem. I've never met an alcoholic who does not believe in beauty, who does not believe in meaning, who does not believe in art, who doesn't believe in the transporting effects of music. And if you tell them, hey, break down that song that you love, explain to me why it's beautiful. Explain to me why it gives you the God shivers. Explain to me why it gives you goosebumps and hair on end. And every time you hear it, you start crying, not in a weepy, not in a sad, depressed way, but just about the inexpressible beauty that can exist in the world. And what if that, what if all of that are just manifestations of God? That's the God that I'm in love with. That's the God that I see in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I'm a peak experience guy. And if you give me a peak experience, I will chase that experience. That can be a problem. But my first experience of God was this. I'm on day 5 of my sobriety. and I'm at the round table, my first home group, and it's kind of an anything goes group. It's known around town as a step one group. Very rowdy, which I needed. It very, very kind of like sometimes you don't even know you're in AA meeting, but it, you know, but then somebody will inevitably come up and talk about alcoholism and the solution for alcoholism, which is taking these 12 steps. And all week long, like I haven't had I find myself laughing this Friday. And it's not the kind of mean-spirited laughing at someone else's expense. You know, ha ha! And it's also not the sort of laughter at like internal stimuli that terrifies people that care about you. Instead, someone's sharing about something horrible. You can share about that from the podium was my experience inside. But we're all laughing about it because we identify. We have that gift of identification. We're all laughing. We get that little space of. Anne Lamott calls laughter carbonated holiness, and I love that. And we're laughing, and it feels like there's this tremendous energy in the room. It's kind of like when my favorite guitarist—we were just talking about music—when my favorite guitarist gets the Fender up against the Telecaster, Stratocaster up against the Marshall Shack, and like weird that amazing feedback in the solo. Or for the younger people, when the DJ just turns the bass all the way up to 11, and the lights are about to come on after this track, but right now it's like, and you feel it all through, like it's going through each person, it's going through everybody, like all the glow sticks are out, we're blowing whistles, everything going on. And it just feels like this entire energy that's flowing through the room going, wow, wow, wow. And it feels like back in Tuscaloosa, Alabama in first grade when my mama would take me to the handy-dandy store and I would look for those two mirrors that are facing each other and go, oh, look, it's me. And I'm feeling that in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go outside after that and I go to my sponsor, Wild Bill, and I'm like, Wild Bill, what was that? That was freaking amazing. That was so good. And he goes, what? I mean, that laughter, that feeling, that like we all felt like, well, yeah, I told him that. And he's like, oh, that? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, that's God, buddy. What the f... no, really. And he's like, no, buddy, that's God. And I'm like, oh, really? He's like, yeah. Well, I want more of that God. Like, how can I get more of that God? And he says, I'll keep coming back, buddy. Keep coming back. And I want that to be my experience of God all the time, but instead I have things happen like when my father was dying, he fell down in Japan on a trip with my brother and his wife, who was his new wife at the time, they're still married. Then he came back to Claremont, California, and fell down and then couldn't get up. And then by January, he couldn't sit up on his own, and he basically all the myelin around his neurons. Started to disappear. The myelin growth is what allows child development to happen. You know, to go from just lying there to being able to kind of roll over, to be able to push yourself up, to be able to sit, to be able to pull yourself up and crawl along a wall, and then to walk. And he was doing that backwards, like on speed. It was like Parkinson's on speed or something. And at night he would forget his he would thank you. He would forget English and. And thanks to going to that little Japanese-speaking meeting, you know, that I was able to talk to him in Japanese. And every Monday, after the two 10-minute speakers and the break, I would find myself just weeping. I was just weeping in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the same thing happened after when my mom died during COVID. I'm speaking on a meeting like that night. And I'm just weeping and telling the people, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm here to show you that, you know, your mama can die and you could still stay sober and be in a meeting. But I remember like crying like that. And I've never been to an orgy before, but it felt like it might have been a little bit like that because like there were hands on me and like rubbing me from like it felt really nice, but I had no idea who it was. And at my lowest moments, where it's like when my mom died, like feeling like, you know, the ground had been pulled out from underneath me and I'm staring into the abyss and the abyss stares back like Nietzsche talks about. And that as long as I'm facing Alcoholics Anonymous, I know you'll catch me. And I always know that there's somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous who's gone through anything that can happen to me. I know that there's someone here in this group, in my group, that has gone through it before, that can show me how to stay sober through it. I'm so, so grateful to be linked up in a sponsorship chain and linked up with a home group, linked up to a group like yours. I'm so grateful to be linked up to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope I never leave. I hope you don't either. Thank you.